Hello, and welcome to Rethinking Legal Law, a podcast by Speed Legal. I'm Ishwari Saxena, and here we talk to legal experts, industry leaders, and innovators about the many ways that legal tech is transforming the way we practice law. Today, I'm very happy to have both amazing speakers with me. Stefania, she is a pioneer in legal design. She's founded her own consulting called Passera Design. She's also a designer in residence at the WorldCC, World Commerce and Contracting. And we also have Paula. Paula is a very experienced and expert attorney. She has worked at IBM as senior counsel. She is also a legal innovation designer in residence at WorldCC, and it is such a privilege to have you both over here. And Paula also has her own legal innovation consulting company called
I'm sorry, I probably should have expanded on my name on the front, but it just says Paula, but that's fine. You've introduced me well.
Just search her on LinkedIn since we're already here.
Exactly.
I'm sure all
thank you for
are,
having us.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And Paula, I'm sure all our listeners already have seen and heard about your work, so I don't think you need to put your name.
I won't be so arrogant to think that.
I am the Paula.
Right, ladies, again, so wonderful to have you here, and I cannot wait to learn more about and also share with our listeners more about both of your professional journeys. And I think we'll start with Stefania. Can you tell us a bit about what your academic journey was like and your professional journey, and how did you end up at legal design?
So I ended up being a legal designer without trying to be a legal designer. I was Steve Jobs like to say, you can see the connecting dots only looking backwards. I think that I only wanted doing interesting things and trying to do things that the like more normal graphic designers or information designers weren't doing. So when I met Helena Hapio, who's another legal design pioneer more than 10 years ago, and talking with her, I just started asking, okay, why no one is using visualizations in contract? Why no one is using information design techniques in contract? I mean, it's we have these techniques that can help us to communicate more effectively. It's not rocket science. It's not a secret. Why is it not happening? And that's how I started my research journey, because I wanted to know, is it a matter of culture? Is it a matter of feasibility? Because I just couldn't accept that no one had just simply thought about it, because it was so obvious to me. And that's why at the beginning I was talking more about contract visualization, because, you know, when you're doing research, you have to be like hyper-focused and test basically one thing, and that is 5 years of your life. But while I was doing this, it kind of took a life of its own, and I started getting calls from organizations saying, we read all your papers. And I was like, is this a joke? No one reads academic papers, so who are you? No, we are really from organization such and such, and we read all your papers, and we want to do it. How much does it cost? So I was like, okay, I guess I'm not only a researcher, I guess I'm a consultant too, and I'm in business. And that's how it started. I was wearing, you know, I was saying before that I wear many hats, so I've been wearing these two hats for a while, until when I defended my PhD, and then for the past 5 years, I've been a contract designer / legal designer full-time, so I'm really proud and happy that I haven't done normal design in more than 5 years. I only ever touch legal documents, contracts, policies, compliance documents, and so on. And so this very briefly was my journey to become a designer.
That is incredible. And I love how you sort of use your creativity and you're just like putting like, you know, good research and your work out there. And then you just sort of organically got recognized. I really, really admire that. And Paula, as you know, from practicing as an attorney, being in-house to getting into legal innovation, what was that journey like for you?
Yeah, I mean, that was a kind of an unusual journey, because you get to a very senior level in-house and legal. And I got to a stage where I thought, OK, do I live and die as a lawyer, or do I do something different? I was quite keen to get out into doing something innovative. I had been quite business oriented within IBM, and so that step, kind of using my legal skills but being more in the business, was something that interested me. So I initially left IBM to go to a startup. I was using my legal services background, but I was working for the business side. It was during that time that I met, well, I had originally met Tim Cummins actually at IBM, but I got to know him better while I was at Globality. We became one of the sponsors of World CC at a conference. And I started doing research with Tim Cummins, who's the founder of World CC. Anyway, long story short, I then started to work for World CC full time, which is where I met Stefania Passera. And it was an area that I was kind of put into. I had really started my interest at IBM in simplification because I'd been part of a round of simplification of the IBM cloud terms. But it was a very sort of nascent simplification. It was just making it shorter, making it a little bit more understandable, but not at the level Stefania was working. And then I started working with Stefania, and I just thought, wow, I mean, I saw the light. And I thought, my legal skills can really come to use here, where I can work with Stefania, helping clients with the legal background to transform their T's and C's. And we started to have this very symbiotic relationship, whereas Stefania had the experience on the information side and the designer side, but I had that legal background where I could bring my years of knowledge to actually making sure that the contract works from a legal perspective. And we found that clients love that combination. They kind of like the security of there's a lawyer doing it, but also the fact that there's a non-lawyer doing the design work. And that's how we kind of ended up, really, we're both independent consultants now, but we do our own thing too. I work a bit with legal tech. I'm very interested in legal tech and some startups. And Stefania does her own thing as well. But we come together on a lot of time projects.
Wonderful. I really like how you emphasize that, for like clients, it was, they had that sort of safety or like feeling secure that there is a lawyer, but then there's also like the non-lawyer aspect of things. And so much of legal practice is becoming interdisciplinary now. I mean, law firms are also hiring like engineers, people with like tech backgrounds, or just like more finance people because there's so much good stuff that happens out of that sort of like collaboration between different disciplines. And I think that's what really excites me about just legal innovation and design personally. I remember this conversation I was having on this podcast with Marco Mendola just last week, and he was talking about how he uses so many like of his like I mean of course like there's like the training that you receive as a lawyer, but then there's also so much like natural creativity that you're just born with, and you just need to like unlock it. And sometimes as we're going through law school, you don't realize that you can be creative with the way you do your contracts. You can be creative with the way you approach legal work. And I think that just opens up so many different avenues, and it's inspiring to hear about your career, Paula, and then also of course your journey, Stefania, as to how you changed your maybe like your mindset that maybe you had from your training as a lawyer, and are doing very cool innovative work. So congrats on that.
So, I mean, I think for me, Stefania kind of unlocked my creativity. I think the and there may be other lawyers out there who are more creative than me, but it's kind of actually having somebody. Stefania hasn't trained as a lawyer, actually. She's trained as a designer, and having that sort of difference, I think, helped to open up the art of the possible. And I see myself continuing to get more and more excited about contract innovation and what can be done through contracts. And now I find myself thinking, why have we, for so long, lawyers, pretty much written contracts the same? It's for decades, almost hundreds of years when you think. Yes, if you look back at contracts 100 years ago, they weren't actually that different to the majority of contracts. It is changing now. And that's a very exciting space to be in. And it's about time.
Yeah, it is about time, exactly. And that was a great segue into my first question to you both. And Paula, I'd like to hear from you about this first. So why is it so important to make contracts user-friendly?
Well, first and foremost, it's to so that all stakeholders can understand contracts. So when you think about it, the journey of contracts up until sort of 5 years ago when Stefania started pioneering legal design, and it is exponentially beginning to grow. I can really see it taking off. There was this is a contract, this is your training, this is how you write a contract. And although I had an instinct that it could be simpler, I have to admit, I didn't think that I could architect it in a different way. You sort of have a mindset. But then what we found is that generally salespeople, business people, they didn't understand the contracts. When I was at IBM, as soon as a contract would come in the door from the other side, it would be lumped onto our lap. And we didn't have that many resources. So we were trying to encourage the business to get more involved with contracts. But when contracts are full of legalese, when they're not easy to navigate, how can we expect business people to understand them and to interact with them? So, they must become more usable. And I don't know if you heard about the recent Ig Nobel Award that was awarded to the MIT cognitive scientists. I thought that was just fascinating, where they were sort of shedding some light on legalese. And now they have proven, which we knew, something we knew, but scientifically, that actually most contracts are not understandable. And I would even say, even by lawyers. I mean, I have gone into, prior to a negotiation, literally into a room, for hours with a cold towel. I always think a cold towel over my head, rereading clauses to try and understand them. I mean, it's madness, really. You need to unlock contracts for everyone. And that's why I'm so passionate about it now.
I completely agree that lawyers are among the bamboozled sometimes. I have firsthand experience because when we were talking before about collaboration, it's not only the symbiotic relationship that there is within the team, but you basically start breaking the boundaries and have this symbiotic relationship with the subject matter experts on your client side. So the legal team, the business team, especially. Because you need to basically go in and understand what they're doing. And I heard all sort of stories. And sometimes when you're trying to explain something, like, okay, explain me like I'm five, or you are playing back their clauses to them and say, okay, if I read this, let me paraphrase it for you. Is this what you're trying to say? And sometimes they go, oh, no, that's absolutely not what you say. Are we really saying that? Oh, no, then we have a problem. Or then, when they have these overcomplicated clauses with indemnitors and indemnities, and then they start using them wrong because they get confused too, or they copy paste it wrong. So that's something important that is not like the profession you have is going to necessarily give you an edge when there is this excessive complexity, this extraneous complexity. So there is intrinsic complexity. So are we talking about something intrinsically difficult? And that is fine, but we should definitely get rid of the extrinsic one that is the self-inflicted complexity there. And I mean, to me, this is a design problem. It's like contracts are written the way they are because we don't think about the user tasks. We don't, no one reads these things for fun. People are reading to do a certain task. So we need to start to understand the roles, the jobs, the function, the cognitive work and the behavioral relational work that people have to do with this information, because that is the context. That is where we get inspiration to design things right. If we don't understand that, we just wordsmithing, we're not going very, very far.
No, absolutely. And I think both of you like bring up very important points as to how important it is for to understand like who is reading these contracts and what is the task that they are trying to accomplish. When I was thinking about going to law school, and when I one of the things that really inspired me about the law was the language. I found maybe I'm like one of those weird people, but like I found legal language and like the comprehension to be it was fascinating to read it. And I felt like these words are so powerful. They can like establish relationships, they can make social change. I mean, there's so much you can do with like words and law. But then in my first year of law school, was quite disillusioned because I was like, no one really understands any of this. Like, I don't even understand it. And I'm, at this school, like actually getting trained to understand this stuff. Like, maybe it looks nice from the outside. And it's just so important to, remove that self-inflicted excessive complexity that no one really needs, because one of the most important thing a contract can do in established relationships. And like, when people don't even understand what these terms are, I don't think that's a very healthy way of like beginning a business relationship.
Yeah, when you read a contract and you're 5 pages in, it's like, what is this contract about? Who is buying what? Like, what are they doing? And you're already on the fifth page. It's kind of disheartening.
And we've seen the difference, we see the difference. I mean, it's quite transformational. And World CC has data. We have our own data from our clients. I mean, it transforms contract negotiations when actually people understand them, and it accelerates those contract negotiations. And let's face it, most people don't want to spend, most businesses don't want to spend a long time in negotiation of contracts. They just want to get on and do the business. So it's a no-brainer, and it's a no-brainer that's been so long coming. I can't believe it. And then on the consumer side, let's not forget about the consumer, because Stefania and I have worked with some clients and banks who are making, reforming their, redesigning their consumer terms to make them more understandable, to make them more accessible to consumers. Consumers have been bamboozled by legalese and, in a way that was not necessary. And I think, really had an influence on their access to justice. And so I'm a real proponent too that, we need to do it, from top down and from bottom up, so that everybody understands what they're agreeing to.
Absolutely, yeah. And you bring up a very important point. Like, it's not just about like businesses, it's also about accessibility of a document that's supposed to, give you some rights, impose some obligations, and everyone should be able to understand it like quite simply, because that's like the purpose of a contract. You also remind me of some of a conversation I had with Electra, from TLB, and yes, and we were talking about how standardization is also like part of a really big part of the solution, and it reminded me of a conversation I had with someone from Ironclad. Earlier than that they had said this line, which really stuck with me, and it's like, a lot of lawyers think that every contract they draft, like, it's like a masterpiece, or like, it's like its own original, like, piece of art, but really, like, most times it's just the print. Like, you just have one, and then you just keep reusing, and like, for a long time we've been using similar templates, like similar language, and it's time to just get out of that pattern and just, unlock creativity, because there's just so much more that, we can do as lawyers. Which leads me to my next question. Stefania, you were talking about visualization that you work with. How do you think visualization helps with making contracts more accessible and more understandable?
Right, I'll get to there, but to keep with the legal or lampooning the legal, I'll start with a disclaimer because this is a point I'm really keen on making, especially with people who may not really be that much into legal design or contract design. And you see some example and you get really excited, and the only thing you remember are pictures. So many people are convinced you can take a piece of crap of a contract, make it nice, and suddenly magic is going to start happening. And that's not the point. That's not the point, because visualization, like plain language, information architecture, anything else that we may do deliberately to design a contract is part of the design. So design is how it works and not necessarily how it looks. Of course, most of us are visual animals. We are, if we have the sense of sight, that is the channel through which we get most of our information. So we tend, at least us sighted users, to interpret information also visually. So for the first thing that visualization, or at least visual communication or visual encoding of information can do for us, is to break down the wall of text. So you can have, so actually starting to design the text just by giving it a different visual hierarchy, spacing, rhythm, positioning things differently, because our brain is gonna catch on those and make inferences. And those inferences, if the presentation is aligned with the logic of the message, is going to help us interpret, finding information, skim it, interpret it correctly, and so on. And that's the first thing. So sort of a hygiene factor, making it legible, open, searchable, skimmable, and so on, because no one reads like an OCR machine, character by character. Mm-hmm. We are really messy readers, and we're trying to cut corners because the brain is lazy. The second thing that we can do is to give salience to certain information. This is something that I try to stress with lawyers in training, that when I ask, what is the most important information? Oh, but everything is important. Like, yes, I know everything is important, but the human brain doesn't know that. A person can only pay attention to something at the disadvantage, at the price of ignoring other things. That's how it works. It's like a light in the dark, our brain. So if I pay attention to this, I'm not going to pay attention to you. If I'm paying attention to Paula, I'm not going to see you. And that's exactly the same with contracts. So I'm saying we should be Pareto efficient. If you manage even to communicate 80% of the information instead of trying to communicate 100, it's going to be better. So you can use visuals to make sure that those key points are grasped, because it's still going to be better than zero. And let's face it, if a document is not engaging, you try to communicate 100 and people are going to get zero because they're not going to read. The last thing that visuals can do for us is to tackle information that is not best expressed into prose. For example, processes. Use a timeline, use a flow chart, incoterms, use a diagram to mark exactly where the delivery is happening, where the risk has been transferred. For example, use tables to structure the information and making it, once again, skimmable and comparable. So it has a role into how we interpret information. Of course, you cannot just do that and live with legalese, because the benefits are going to be limited. That is what I was testing in my PhD. And even if you keep the legalese, there's going to be an effect. But if you want to, I mean, go big or go home, it doesn't make sense to have only plain language or using visual communication, because you're not going to get the full package. And that's where, you know, when you put together content and how you talk about it, and think of tone of voice, and think of medium, and think of narrative and storytelling and user needs, and all of the things start getting a bit more holistic, and you start changing how a contract really works, how it's used.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, that makes me think of the new Google privacy policy. Like, they've used a lot of those, like, visuals, like, you know, like, with, like, every term to sort of explain, like, you know, provide this additional, like, visual aid to, like, understanding, like, what's really going on with the contract. And when you say that, when it's just, like, a wall of text, and it's, like, very, like, incomprehensible and, like, hard to understand, you're communicating like 0%. So having that, like, little extra there just to maybe increase how much people can infer from it is so important. Paula, what has your experience been innovating in this space, and also with, like, contract visualization? What kind of trends maybe you've seen, or how effective do you think it has been?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really effective. It's not something that I saw that much of until I started at WorldCC, because there are still, what we find is there are still some sort of more traditional clients who kind of think, oh, putting pictures in contracts, they just don't belong. Mm-hmm. I think when I saw Shell doing it, and Shell are doing it across all their contracts, I think that opened it up for a lot of people. They were thinking, oh, well, Shell can do it, we can do it. And it's what Stefania says, actually, too, is because sometimes it's true, isn't it, Stefania, when we get on our first call with clients, they say, no, we don't want any pictures. But as Fanny is saying, it's not about, you know, putting pretty pictures. It can be. There are comic contracts that can be very. Rob DeRoy is a great person who's done a lot of work in this space and fantastic. But tables, flow charts, all of those things that aid understanding, it can only be positive.
Mm-hmm. It can end up looking prettier than a wall of text, but that's not the point. If you're just, okay, I need to make it a little bit more visual because it's still a bit too textual and you're just forcing it, but you don't know why you're doing it. It's not going to help much, to be honest.
Yeah. So there has to be a reason. That's my belief.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just in law school and my experience as well, like, I remember, like, we were supposed to, like, write a report. And, like, one of the instructions was, like, do not use pictures, like, you know, use, like, you know, original text, like, written by you. And it's just the way law was taught. Like, I studied law in India and then later on in the U.S. And I did see, like, a difference between both countries, but still very... very, very text dependent when there's so much more, so much better ways that we can communicate. And like visually, I think it's a big, big part of that solution. It's not necessary that, like, you know, maybe lawyers, not all lawyers can be artists, or not all lawyers can be like very creativity or like can be very like creative with like visual design and stuff. So how much would you say, and this one I'll ask you first, Paula, but how much would you say that contract, legal design is, you know, unlocking just like the true power of contracts and making them more understandable, even from the perspective of someone that maybe doesn't appreciate as much like flowcharts or doesn't like need, maybe they, you know, they're perfectly comfortable reading just like a wall of text. So in those cases, how is it still unlocking the benefits of a contract?
Well, I mean, simplification. So you don't have to include visualization. I mean, some of the work actually that Stefania has done has, I'm thinking of Equivadis, Stefania, where Equivadis originally were fairly conservative in what they wanted to do, you know, and they had a limited budget. There wasn't much visual design at all in there, but what Stefania...
Yes, mostly layout and structure, really. Yeah. There wasn't big diagrams or
but that
items
was
everywhere.
Yeah, that was transformative. I mean, that's the bit as a lawyer, and I think all lawyers now get it. You know, we can organize the, even if you don't want any icons, you don't want any visualizations, you can organize the information in a way that makes it much more accessible. And that is a no-brainer. And actually what happened during COVID and during the pandemic, and we have really seen the uptick in organizations and huge global organizations now wanting to redesign their contracts, because what they found out is they couldn't find the information in their contracts that they needed to know, you know, where were their force majeure clauses, what were the consequences. It wasn't just force majeure. And actually we talk about that sort of wall of text, and we talk about lawyers reading it, and it was interesting, you know, the MIT, the cognitive scientists were saying how lawyers, we're bored with legalese. That is, you know, to be honest, our attention spans are not what they used to be. We're used to skimming our phones. We're used to skimming information. So Stefania mentioned earlier, skimmable, making the information skimmable so that you can easily extract the information you want. And without visualizations, you can really transform contracts. So it's a no-brainer. Everybody's got to do it. And my belief, I'm almost prepared. Anybody contact me, put this date down in 10 years' time. If you can show me a traditional contract full of legalese being used by a global organization, I will definitely buy you a drink, because I think this is the beginning of a snowball effect.
It really is. Really is. I mean, like so many large companies, as you mentioned, Shell, I mean, there's Google, Apple came up with the privacy nutritional labels. And from the other perspective as well, like not just as something that would benefit them as a company and understanding their own contracts, but also building more trust with the customer. Like, you know, privacy is so important. So like they needed to be not as just like, you know, these incomprehensible terms and conditions that like no one really reads. You know, you could be giving away your entire like life savings, so like you could have all those clauses and no one would ever read it, and they would just say, "I agree with the terms and conditions." So it's also a good way of building, you know,
Yeah, and
customer.
I think that's really, Asha, when you mentioned trust there, you know, I should have mentioned it earlier, because if I pick up a set of T's and C's that I think the supplier or the customer who has bothered to invest in to make them more understandable. But it's not only, I am a big, I don't know if it, I'm due another post on LinkedIn. I mean, I'm a big proponent of balance, building greater balance. Stefania and I know sometimes we look to redesign terms and conditions, but you know, you can't, my father used to say, you can't make a silk purse out of a cow's ear. Yeah. You need to, if you want to do something amazing, then you also have to build in that collaboration into your contracts, make them more balanced, make your users, whether they be customers or suppliers, think that you actually give a damn about them. There's no point in sort of redesigning information and making it all about you. I think redesigning and simplifying your contracts is a great opportunity to reassess your risk and also think about making your contracts more collaborative.
Yeah, very,
And
very,
that's
very
how
well.
you make it user-centric, really,
Yeah.
because these are the functions. These are why people are having contracts. They're not only having contracts because one day I'm going to be sued. Business users or consumers don't want to ever be sued. They want to actually prevent these problems. They want to have win-win relationships.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, that contracts should be seen as part of the relationship, should be part of the
Exactly.
conversation, should be part of the customer experience. What makes me absolutely mad is this big brand spending bazillions of dollars on having the most polished brands, and then you look at their contracts and
Yeah. So true. Yeah.
really? No
Yeah.
one has thought of this touch point. And
Yeah.
if you cover your logo, it's going to look like everyone else. Your tone of voice that you're spending millions in developing, and you have a lot of marketing people in your marketing army, like obsessing about that. There's no tone of voice. There's no branding. There's no values. There's no nothing. So all that, there's such a disconnection there.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really about trust. It's about trust. It's about that's the thing, that we tend to think of contracts, or in general, written documents, static documents, as a one-way conversation. But you can actually at least mentally simulate that sort of conversation. You can transform those documents into conversations if you try to see them a little bit from the other part, if you try to make them win-win, if you try to organize information in a way that, you know, like, yeah, they're searching for these three things. Let's put them on top, for example.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's all about that relationship. So you need to give and take to create the trust. The fact that you're making an effort is going to pay back in terms of goodwill.
Yeah.
It's the effort itself that makes the difference. That's what I would like to say. And before, you were saying that legal words are like magic. Actually, that's something that I like to say. Like, contracts are not a magical spell. It's not enough to utter them or to have them on paper and then they're going to make things happen. You need to involve the people, or unless they're smart contracts and, you know, you can tell a robot to do something. But there are so many normal commercial contracts where people in the world need to do real human actions. So sort of like a not hardware, but software meatware, and do stuff. And your contract is only as good as you manage to have people working with and through it
Yeah.
and on top
I
of
would
it.
say. Yeah, I would say at the heart of every good communication and at the heart of every good contract should be empathy. It should, you know, that sounds like, but to be honest, it's something I learned a number of years ago, actually, when I was a lawyer, and it really helped me in negotiations. If you go into a negotiation and the other side, whoever they are, feels you're empathizing, you're able to put yourself in their shoes and you're able to understand their perspective, it can transform negotiations and really help them be more collaborative. And that's what we really like to do when we redesign a contract. We
Yes.
empathize with whoever's going to be using it.
So well said. And I think, we think too much about the business aspect of this. Like, how is it going to help us maybe accomplish these tasks faster? But all businesses, all contracts, they're all about people. So I think, like you're saying, that needs to be more user-centric. There needs to be like more empathy in the way we draft them and the way that we design these contracts. I think that is so relevant and so important. And it is very true that those contracts are becoming part of the package with like a lot of brands. And as Stefania, as you're saying, I think companies are finally starting to feel a little bit embarrassed about their contracts. I mean, Apple creating the privacy nutrition label, Google redesigning its privacy policy, many other companies are coming up with ways to make their contracts more attractive, because I think it's also, as times are changing, people are demanding to know their rights. People are no longer just okay with clicking terms and conditions. Like, it's okay, like just take whatever you want from me, just like let me go use your product. People are making more of those sort of conscious choices that I don't want to go for a brand that is that cannot explain me my rights correctly enough. So that change is really happening, and I think people like you are leading that. And my next question, very sort of on topic to what we're talking about is, and I'll ask this to you first, Estefania, how can legal design help organizations get the most value out of their contracts, like in a negotiation format, just apart from like speed and efficiency? What are some of the other wins that can be that organizations can get when they start thoughtfully designing their contracts?
Well, speed is also money, is also resources, is also not only for the counterparty, but making your own people work better. For example, in EcoVadis, we were that is one of our quite successful cases. So with relatively small changes, they managed to have a big impact. The VP of sales said, like, this is the first time that my people said that in their career they understand the contracts and they're confident about going out and training them on contract doesn't suck, and they're happy to work with this tool. So I think that also that sense of competence that we want to all feel at work is important, that there's value in itself, not having that mental overload so we can be best in other, perhaps more valuable things is also important. So these are perhaps more fluffy things, and people don't put a dollar sign on that, but they are important. And they go hand in hand with, okay, we are saving brain capacity, and of course we're saving money too. What is also important is really, as I was saying before, is the relationship, is the ability to see things a bit differently. So how do I approach the counterparty? Are we able to have better conversations? We know from WorldCC research that one of the pitfalls of contracting is that there isn't very good meeting of the mind. So there's this failure to really manage expectations, or in complex services to really, you have an empty box. It's not like, it's like software in the 90s that it's a CD and it comes on the box. So, and that box doesn't say anything if your contract is not designed. So yeah, it's making things into being. And in some cases, I'm thinking, for example, outsourcing. Maybe it's likely that your client is the first time that they have outsourced that function, and you need to educate them. There's such a big knowledge gap, so they cannot give you the right requirements for you to perform well, and you need to build that image and be on the same page together if you want to be successful. So
Yes.
there is an element of relational contracting and more collaborativeness in how you even draft. I'm thinking, for example, about the vested outsourcing from Kate Vitasek, that approach. So you can be more collaborative in how you design the incentives and the model and so on, but it's also how you sit down and envision things together. And visual thinking, not only visual communication, but visual thinking can help us while we're trying to workshop together or envisioning a transaction or envisioning how something is going to affect something else. These are all tools that come from service design, like doing service blueprints, doing swim lanes. It helps, or stakeholder maps is going to help us figure out how complexity pans out in the real world before it's going to pan out. Because when a service is out, you can only orchestrate it. It's not like you can fix it, and it goes through people and technology once again. So you have all these complex nodes, abstract stuff. And basically, it's all up to the power of our words and communication and sense making and sense giving to be aligned together. And we know that if you're not scoping things well, if you're not managing expectations, then you're going to start leaking value as much as 9% of your turnover a year. So
it's
a staggering number.
Yeah.
And this is just one of the different pitfalls of contracting, but it's a very severe one.
Yeah, it's a very severe one. I mean, badly drafted contracts, badly drafted scope is often the subject of large disputes, the hemorrhage contract value.
Yeah.
And I also think that just interjecting there that one thing that's really good and a real benefit also of well-designed contracts is the fact that actually you can use them for implementation. So I'm thinking about my times at, you know, in IBM, you know, the big services contracts that were very complex to negotiate, and outsourcing contracts actually quite complex operationally. And then there would be this huge effort after you negotiating the contract for months and months to then write the contract guide so that it could be interpreted by the people who were non-lawyers going to actually project manage and implement the project. But when you think about it, why have all that effort and time? You can design the contract informationally in a way that actually simplifies how you're going to do things and what you're going to do. And so you're killing, you know, two birds with one stone. It doesn't make sense to have a contract full of legalese then translated into plain language for implementation. Let's use it for both.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen awful contract guides.
And that's basically a big resource and cost implication. And we know that CEOs and CFOs now, they're the ones who are actually saying to the general counsels, we've heard about contract simplification. Why aren't we doing it to our contracts?
Yeah, yeah. Very, very, very true. And that is like so true. I mean, like part of my job as a legal intern at like the companies that I've worked at was to just like create these summary reports out of contracts, like in simple English, that would be then sent to like the senior level management. So, I mean, that's just such a waste of time. Like maybe at the outset, you know, we should just design contracts to be more understandable.
And I saw even more awful things. At least you were trying to make them in simple English. In some big organizations, sometimes they send them in some service center. In the case, I was talking with this company, they said that we send it to India, where our assistants are making these contract guides. And say, okay, can I see the contract guides? And these contract guides were basically 100 slides of 100 pages contract, where these assistants that probably didn't have a legal background or didn't know anything about contracts, they were basically taking pieces of the contract and copy pasting it. So I was like, okay, you're just taking some pieces and putting them there. It's just putting them from one hand to the other. But it's, you know, it's and it was still better because I don't know, at least it was in PowerPoint, so managers would try to read it and it would be a little bit less than a wall of text, but they were copy pasting clauses.
Yeah,
it wasn't really a summary, it wasn't really a guide. When we do contract guides, we really work with business and managers to say, okay, how do you want to brief people? Yeah. Let's come up with a effective approach, effective metaphors, effective visualizations that make the point to your people.
Yeah.
So that it's legally correct. So we're not misrepresenting it, but it's effective. Bam, for them, go and doing it. Or monitoring the risk, or monitoring, okay, are we on track? Copy pasting clauses and making 100 pages decks. Like, text like this is not helping anyone.
Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, that's just like copy pasting in a PowerPoint. Like the things we do that, you know, as just an industry, like we do realize that there are all these efficiencies, and like, you know, we have come up with some solutions. But I'm just glad that, you know, that there is now, you know, like more like widespread awareness about legal design, and specialized professionals like, you know, doing this type of work. So, you know, we can finally move on from stuff like that, which brings me to my next question to you, Paula. Where do you see is the intersection, or what kind of potential do you see for an integration between, you know, legal design as a skill, and then, you know, combining that with legal tech tools that are available out there? And what kind of values do you see for companies for using them in integration with one another?
Yeah, I mean, that's really kind of dear to my heart, because I am working with some startups and legal tech startups that are actually trying to, you know, use technology to improve legal services. And legal design has to be part of that. I mean, the user journey, we're talking about empathy, information. How do you communicate? Well, I mean, there's a complete intersection. I would say one of the big problems with legal technology is currently is that it actually hasn't had enough legal design. The user journey is still a problem, and that is a problem with adoption, because unless you have something that's easy to use and intuitive to use, you won't use it. Lawyers are very busy in-house. Sometimes they're deploying big CLMs, actually getting them to use it is problematic. And to be honest, I have been talking to some of the big CLMs, and they are getting it now. They are really concentrating on the user journey. So there's a natural intersection there. And then I would also say that in time too, and we know too, CLM systems are becoming more intelligent. If you have information, you know, they talk garbage in, garbage out. If you have information presented and designed in a contract in a way that makes sense, has is skimmable, has some kind of order to it, then you're going to be able to interrogate those contracts easier using AI and get the data out. I still think that's a really exciting part of contracting that still is quite nascent in its exploration. All the data in contracts, we haven't really started mining it and using it properly. And that's partly to do with the fact that the technology hasn't really been there in the past. And I do know there's a lot of technology focusing on that, because there's a huge amount of data. So the design is just integral. It's integral in every part. And I would say to any legal technologists out there, you need to get designers working with you. They should be. Because it's all about how you're presenting legal information ultimately with your users.
Yeah. But it's really a loop, because the better technology you deploy, you can design and make people use, the more data you're going to have, for example, about your contracts. I was talking today with the president of WorldCC, and we're saying, okay, how many companies we're still going, and when we're starting a design project and saying like, okay, do you know what's the average time to close a deal? Oh, we don't know. Like, why don't you know? Ah, we don't have a way to track it. We can put a finger up in the air. More or less is like this, but they don't have metrics. Yeah. And if you don't have metrics, you cannot really innovate your function and be agile and do experiments to see what improves your metrics. So when you're thinking of design thinking and being agile and having the cycle of ideation, testing, learning, iterating, and so on, that's where it really goes hand in hand. The other thing, well, this is more tongue-in-cheek, but when I hear legal tech companies saying, oh, it's designed by lawyers for lawyers, and they think it's good marketing, that's terrifying. That's terrifying. I want a surgeon to operate on me. Just call the designers and the user researchers and the UX researchers to develop decent user personas and user journeys. Because that's what they're good at doing. So you have to use the best at doing that.
That's true. Although, Stefania, I will say I have helped some legal tech companies with user journeys. And that's because I am by my nature, a sort of noddy user. So I naturally need my tech to be simple. So in a way, there can be some lawyers who can be useful because I kind of know what I need out of it, but I need it in a simple way because otherwise I just get too confused. So from that perspective, we have some role to play, but that's why we need the designers as well.
Yeah.
No, definitely. Yeah. I mean, one should talk with users as lawyers. Yeah. Lawyers are users to know what they want.
Yeah.
But, you know, not everyone is good at doing research. So call good researchers to talk with your users and analyze that stuff and come back with good insights. I think that was my point. Don't try to be, I want to be a lawyer and a technologist and a designer and a researcher and I'm going to do everything by myself because I'm a lawyer and this should be designed by lawyers for lawyers. Otherwise, it's not good enough. I mean, that's something that we need to get over with, I think.
Yeah. No, I think like the legal industry in general, I mean, there's just a big need for more integration, you know, from other disciplines, because again, like, you know, someone with a tech background or someone with like a more research background, they'll just bring something very different to the table that someone, you know, who's had a lot of experience working, you know, in-house or someone, you know, like just more like a litigator would, you know, just bring in something very different. So I think that sort of collaboration, I think, in law and legal design and legal tech is so, so important. But this has been a wonderful conversation, Stefania and Paula. Thank you so much for all your insights. And we are unfortunately on time. I would have loved to keep going on and on about this. This has been so fun. And our listeners, I'm sure, are very happy to tune in today as well. So thank you so much again for such a great episode.
Great. Thank you very much for having us. We've really enjoyed it. And it's, happy to do it again sometime.
Lovely chat. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And thank you again to our listeners for tuning in. Remember, we're here every Thursday with more episodes. And please do check out Stefania's work at Passera Design and Paula's work at Palida. They're doing some really groundbreaking stuff. And see everyone next time.
The practice of law is changing, and we're here for it. Thank you so much for tuning in for today's episode of Rethinking Legal Ops. Follow us for more such insightful conversations about the transformative impact of legal tech. Also, follow Speed Legal and let us know in your comments and messages about how you leverage legal tech solutions to make your work more efficient. See you next time.